At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Two things about this inauguration day. Number one, there is finally an app for that. And number two, despite all the pomp and circumstance, politics is still all about the money. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Inauguration Day 2013. It's Monday, the 21st of January. Glad you could be with us. You know, as much work as the president has in front of him over the next 4 years, there is one thing he is never, ever going to have to do again. Run for any kind of office if he doesn't want to. So, what to do with the formidable database that his campaign built, along with its network of volunteers? Well, how about a good rebranding? Obama for America will henceforth be known as Organizing for Action. It's supposed to help the president push his policy agenda. But as with all things political, the very first thing you got to do is follow the money. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has that story.
The nonprofit Organizing for Action is designed to rally grassroots supporters, as Executive Director John Carson explains in this video.
Talk to your friends and neighbors about three of our biggest priorities that are coming up very quickly: immigration reform, reducing gun violence, and tackling the budget in a balanced way.
Under the tax rules, the nonprofit can accept unlimited contributions from corporations and keep the donations secret, though officials with Organizing for Action have promised to make the donors list public. But the funding still raises issues for some government watchdogs. Paul Seamus Ryan is with the Nonpartisan Campaign Legal Center.
Anytime you have public officials raising big contributions from business or from individuals or organized labor for that matter, the concern is that the money will sway the public decision-makers' actions.
Former Democratic Party leader Howard Dean has no problem with individual donors.
The idea that this is really meant to somehow buy influence is pretty silly, because this is not advancing the president's election. What this is advancing is his agenda.
But he hopes the nonprofit won't take money from corporations.
When corporations get involved in donating to politics, their consumer base gets upset, which is not good for business, and it does lead to difficult perceptions.
Organizing for Action doesn't need any donations to get started. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the Obama campaign still has about $5 million left over. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
If all you did today was watch the inauguration on television, you kind of missed half the ball game. There was twittering about it galore. More pictures on Instagram than you can shake a stick at. The Congressional Inaugural Committee has a new app out as well, all of which struck Steve Freeze from Politico curious, because honestly, the digital age has been around for a while and inaugurations are just now getting to it. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Well, so what is it about inaugurals and this lagging indicator they are of technology?
Well, that's the thing. You know, I started working on this story because I thought it would be interesting to kind of track the technological progress. And what I found was that everything was a bit behind. You know, the car, the Model T, came off the assembly line in 1908. But the first time the Americans saw their president moved from the White House to the Capitol for inauguration was 1921. And it was because Woodrow Wilson was too sick to ride in a horse-drawn carriage. So, I mean, what I gather is that the idea here is that the inauguration is a traditional event. It is not sort of the time for innovation or trying something new.
Which I get, right? I mean, Obama will take the same oath as George Washington did. But I was struck by this opening line in your story the other day that photography had been around for 40 years before somebody thought to take a picture of James Buchanan in 1857.
Yeah. I mean, of course, hello? it wasn't, you know, bringing a small device to it. But
yeah,
you know, and we're not talking about the first picture of a president, but the first picture of a president being inaugurated.
Right, right. Talk to me about this app for a minute. It's an interesting creature because it has become a little bit politicized, I guess.
Yes. It is an app that tells you where the bathrooms are on the mall. It tells you where your tickets ought to be. It helps you sign up if you wanted to do some volunteer work over the weekend at the National Day of Service. But if you read the fine print, what it says is that they can take all that information you give them and they can use it for Democratic causes. And that's a capital D Democratic.
Which is interesting because, at least it's my understanding, that the inaugural committee of the Congress is bipartisan, officially bipartisan.
It is officially bipartisan. The chairs of the inaugural committee are the four living former presidents, two of whom are Republicans.
So as this app gathers this data, and I don't actually know, you know, how many people have downloaded it or anything, one imagines it fits neatly in with the machine that the Obama administration built during the campaign.
The way that the disclaimer is written, it really does say that they are allowed to give this information to the Democratic causes or sort of like-minded interest groups of their choosing, basically, of people they think you would agree with. But the thing about it is, and this is different than a campaign, this is the inauguration of the president. It doesn't necessarily mean it's the inauguration of a Democratic or Republican president.
Yeah.
And a lot of the people who are coming today, I would imagine, are just here because it's a patriotic tradition and they would just want to take it in, not necessarily because they want to be on the email list for some senator somewhere.
Steve Freese covers technology for Politico. Steve, thanks a bunch.
Thank you very much for having me.
Wall Street took the day off today. Still, the rest of the world was trading. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It bears remembering that the reason today is a federal holiday has nothing to do with what happened at the Capitol building this morning. Something like a million people every year visit the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent Social Change, the King Center, down in Atlanta. The center is a powerful reminder of Dr. King's importance in this country's history. But visitors to the center often take away another memory, one of urban economic decay. Marketplace's Jim Burris has that story.
The Sweet Auburn Bread Company is the kind of place that will make your mouth water.
You can call me Chef Sonia.
Over top the hum of industrial-sized ovens and mixers, Sonia Jones tells me she started this bakery 15 years ago.
And I named the bakery for this district. I like to say that I'm a native Atlantan. And so I do remember coming downtown to the Sweet Auburn Market and just remember those days.
They were good days. The decades leading up to the Civil Rights Movement were the Sweet Auburn neighborhood's heyday. In 1956, Fortune magazine dubbed Auburn Avenue the, quote, richest Negro street in the world. Martin Luther King Jr. grew up on Auburn Avenue. Ebenezer Baptist, where he preached, is here too. That connection to the African American community is why Chef Sonia wants to be on Auburn Avenue. As she folds in the ingredients for her favorite recipe, oatmeal raisin cookies, she shares stories, like the time she fed President Clinton, or when she appeared on the Food Network. Then there's the cookbook she authored.
Up and now. I climb one hill and, ooh, it's another one.
And how she struggles. Sweet Auburn Bread Company keeps afloat mostly through phone and internet orders. Jones says customers rarely walk through the door. Many are afraid of the neighborhood. Just outside the bakery, cars drive down the rain-soaked street. A scattering of homeless men keep dry under an interstate overpass. To them, everyone who walks by is an opportunity.
I'm not asking no money. Can I ask you one question?
Despite his pledge not to ask for cash, he does. Look around and you have to wonder, what happened to Dr. King's dream on this street? Cliff Kuhn is a history professor at Georgia State University.
As with many African-American communities across the country, an interstate highway bisected it.
That highway, Atlanta's downtown connector, slices through the heart of Auburn Avenue, much like Chef Sonia's knife cuts through her famous pound cake. Kuhn says the interstate was arguably the neighborhood's biggest blow, but not its only one.
The second is actually desegregation itself. Auburn Avenue provided places of employment. Well, after the Civil Rights Act, with the Civil Rights Movement, African Americans could find employment elsewhere.
Decades since of crime, poverty, and abandonment have allowed for the corridor's further decay. That could be changing.
4,000 students right now live in this, right in this area.
Mark Becker is president of Georgia State University, which sits at the north end of Sweet Auburn. The historically commuter campus is becoming more residential. Georgia State recently opened a dorm for 2,000 students on Auburn Avenue. Becker says the neighborhood's latest efforts are promising.
Well, we believe they'll succeed, and we believe that we're an important part of that.
That's great, says Atlanta City Councilman Kwanzaa Hall, whose district includes Sweet Auburn. But he says fixing this neighborhood, where King was born, preached, and is now buried, will take a global effort.
This is an all call to help us make the Sweet Auburn Corridor, the Martin Luther King Historic District, be reflective of the legacy and dream that Dr. King spoke of.
Work is now underway on a streetcar that will link the King Historic District to Atlanta's downtown tourist center. Many think it could be the tipping point in making Sweet Auburn sweet once again. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
If you're of a certain age, you probably remember the pinball machine. You might have even played it a bit back in the day. Flippers and bumpers and ringing bells haven't fared so well in the digital age, though, which is where Jack Guarnieri, the CEO of Jersey Jack Pinball, comes in. He is almost single-handedly trying to revitalize the pinball as a pastime with a new high-tech version of the old-fashioned game based on, of all things, The Wizard of Oz. Jack, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So I imagine it takes a certain amount of passion to decide you're going to revitalize the pinball industry, huh?
Well, it's a passion that I've had for 37 years in the industry, and I love pinball, so this is what we're doing.
How are you doing it, though? I mean, this Wizard of Oz game, how'd you settle on Wizard of Oz?
Well, settle is not the right thing. I wanted it.
But why? I mean, you know, you could do a zillion stories out there.
Yeah, well, you know, when you license a theme, you want something very rich and vibrant. With The Wizard of Oz, we know we want to get Dorothy back to Oz, so we have a whole storyline. We're able to create unique toys and unique mechanisms and playfields and animation. And so, you know, you have a spinning house on the playfield that lands, and the Wicked Witch of the East, her legs pop out of it, and you have a winged monkey that flies down and grabs your captive ball and brings it back up to the witch's castle. So the eye candy of what the game is from a standpoint of work of art, as well as this mechanical action game, is outstanding. That's what gets the play and the repeat play.
Yeah, that's the key, right? The repeat play?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
When you first started thinking about starting up your own company to manufacture these games,
right?
Was it a close call for you? Did you do the cost-benefit thing, or did you go with your gut?
No, I just went with my gut. You know, I knew if I assembled a team of really great people that are passionate and knowledgeable, creative, pinball people, that we'd be successful. And we have an amazing customer base, and the support is there.
You know, you might have a great customer base, but it's probably not the world's biggest customer base, right?
No, but it's big enough for us. I mean, I don't think everybody in the world drives a Bentley or a Mont Blanc. So it seems to work for them. And I think we're going to get this out to the masses, to other people in amusement centers, so that everybody's able to play our pinball machines.
So how much are operators going to have to pay to get your machine in the thing? I mean, how many thousands of dollars?
The game costs $7,000.
And then it takes them a year to make their money back?
It could be less, depending, again, on the location. You know, if you put it on Mars and there's no people there, it could take you forever. So, you know, if you put it in a high traffic location like we've been testing them in, I certainly believe that our game is going to return the money to those people within the year. I could see that happening, and sooner in some locations.
Jack Guarnieri is the CEO of Jersey Jack Pinball. He's out of Lakewood, New Jersey. Jack, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, and I'll hope to see you playing the Jersey Jack pinball machine soon.
I'll look for him, man. I'll look for him.
Absolutely.
Coming up, for some people, happy birthday has a special ring to it today.
Ronan actually came out when the Star Spangled Banner was playing in the room. So we kind of consider it his birth song.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street, as I said, had Martin Luther King Day off, so we bring you today's numbers, the inaugural edition. In keeping with modest expectations for the ceremony, President Obama delivered a 2,100-word inaugural address today. That's down about 300 words from his speech in 2009. He used the word hope 3 times. That's up from 2 last time around. The words equal or equality 7 times today, up from a single mention previously. Tonight's celebrations include 2 official inaugural balls, a slide from 10 after the president's first election. A final inaugural number for you now, 1 hour. That's how long it took for CNN to bring on fashion guru Tim Gunn to discuss Michelle Obama's dress after the end of the ceremony at the Capitol. On a scale of 1 to 10, he gave it a 100. What about the bangs, Tim? The bangs. What about the bangs? You're listening to Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. Johnson & Johnson hopes for no tears when they release their earnings report for the last quarter. We'll get an idea of existing home sales for the month of December from the National Association of Realtors. And on this day in 1970, the Boeing 747 took off for its first regularly scheduled commercial flight. No problems reported while the plane was airborne. Ahem. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Consider Formica, that thin paper-based product that covered and perhaps still does cover millions of kitchen counters and tables and diners across this great country. It's as much a genericized brand name as Kleenex or Jell-O. It's also now 100 years old, and it's coming back in style, as Marketplace's Eve Tro reports.
The word Formica probably brings to mind the suburban kitchens and baths of the 50s, every surface bathed in turquoise, pink, or that classic boomerang pattern. And it wasn't just America. Yes, Formica, a French Formica ad from 1958. But what is Formica exactly? It belongs to a group of products called HPL.
Or high-pressure laminate.
That's Jay Bolus with the chemistry firm MBDC.
Paper and a bunch of different resins smushed together at really, really, really high pressure.
Since it's paper, the top layer can be printed in any color or design. Formica company president Mitch Quint says the product has always been very thin and strong.
And because of that, it ends up being in locations for a significant period of time, you know, 15, 20 years.
Which is why, by the 70s and 80s, Formica had a bit of a bad rap. The smooth surfaces had been chipped or rubbed down to show the brown paper under the pretty colors. By the 90s, expensive stone countertops became a status symbol, paving over passé Formica. But last year, Los Angeles designer Scott Lander used white Formica in an award-winning project.
And most people were asking, what is this surface? Most people didn't even know that it was Formica.
It's also getting more popular with budget remodelers and green builders. The company has switched to non-toxic resins and uses recycled paper. Just one more way Formica is clawing back a little more counter space. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Who knew, right? Okay, so you know how when you travel, you have a list of things you gotta do. If you're in Paris, you go see the Eiffel Tower. New York, you get tickets for a Broadway show. If you're in Hong Kong, the thing a lot of people do is go to a tailor to get a suit or a dress made. It's been that way for years. But the tailoring business in Hong Kong ain't what it used to be, as Charlie Schroeder reports.
Do I need to relax my belly or do I suck it in like I normally
relax.
Do?
Just relax. Otherwise, you'll have to suck in when you wear the shirt.
Getting fitted for a dress shirt can be humbling.
A little bit more.
So that'll be 36 and a half.
What?
Really
no,
humbling.
Not. It is not 36 and a half.
36 and a half.
My waist is?
Yep.
Especially when Ian Fong is measuring me for a form-fitting shirt that makes me never want to eat again. He's the founder of Cuffs, which he says
is a cool tailor.
Fong and his business partner Mario Jatronic are just 2 young Hong Kongers attempting to redefine the tailoring experience here. As Fong puts it, a traditional tailor shop is
fairly frumpy looking, and usually run by an old man.
But not Cuffs. It's spare, clean, and painted white. Dance music fills the space. Here, customers can order their shirts at a shirt bar, and there's lots on the menu.
For example, you can choose your fabric, your collar, cuff, style, linings, details, buttons, all that.
Fong is 31, Jetronic 28. And judging by the number of tailor shops closing here, some new blood may be just what the industry needs. At one point, there were 1,000 tailors in Hong Kong. Today, that number is closer to 400, and it's dropping fast. Consider my usual tailor, Chu Lun Tang. He's 80, and on a recent visit to him, I found out that he was calling it quits this February.
Now the foot no good. The foot got that kind.
Mr. Tang points to his right foot and shakes his head. It hurts for him to stand too long, he says. Like other tailors here, Mr. Tang targeted tourists and Western businessmen. A money-saving move, says Ian Fong.
Simply because the businessmen they visit and then they order 10 shirts and then they leave and then, you know, the chance of them coming back and making adjustments is lower.
And adjustments? Well, they cost time and money. But Cuffs is willing to take them on because their target market is local, young, and choosy. Tucked inside a dark and dated shopping arcade about 5 blocks from Cuffs is Ola Classic, a tailor shop opened by 2 young couples last August. It's rare to see women behind the counter of a men's tailor shop here, but that's not the only way Ola is breaking the mold. They make whimsical tweed suits. Think, Downtown Abbey. 27-year-old Carmen Lam tells me they're targeting the younger local market as well.
So we focused the customers to be 23 to 40 because they still can buy our suit and our products, well.
To appeal to the younger crowd, she says, you've got to offer hip clothing at an affordable price. Ola's suits range between $130 to $260. That's uber cheap. They can keep prices low for now because they have affordable rent, a rarity in the world's most expensive commercial real estate market. Ola partner, Peggy Young.
It's luckily we have this shop signed for a few years, but after that we're not very sure where we can go.
And if they have to move?
This will just make our costs very high and the products will be expensive.
Then there's this challenge facing this new breed. None of these young entrepreneurs are actually tailors. They've all hired older men to make these hip clothes. And what happens when those older men retire?
We hope we can do it.
Or, as Ian Fong tells me, the work will be outsourced to, well, you can probably guess.
Mainly China, simply because there's very few people actually sewing shirts here in Hong Kong anymore.
In Hong Kong, I'm Charlie Schroeder for Marketplace.
Inauguration days are natural pivot points in American history, but for some Americans, they're even a bit more special. A couple of months ago, we teamed up with the Annenberg School at the University of Southern California to find people who were born on inauguration days gone by, and we asked them their thoughts about America in their lifetimes.
Hi, my name is Matthew Wood. I'm a sophomore at Concordia University, Irvine, and I'm from Glendale, Arizona. I was born in Seoul, South Korea on January 20th, 1993. As far as I know, my birth mom, she really couldn't, like, support a child. And then about 6 months into my birth, my real parents from the U.S., they looked into adopting someone from Korea. And so it just happened to be me.
My name is Kira McDonough, and I'm from Chicago, Illinois. And this is my son, Ronan Godo.
Hi.
And Ronan is going to be turning 4 on January 20th.
I've always wondered, really, what life would be like if I stayed in South Korea. It would be a lot more of school in my life, a lot more probably rigorous study than it would be here in the U.S.
I'm Robert Olin Butler, and I'm a novelist, short story writer, and I was born on January 20th, 1945, the day that Franklin Roosevelt was inaugurated for the last time.
And while I was in labor, we were watching the inauguration, and Ronan actually came out when the Star Spangled Banner was playing in the room. So we kind of consider it his birth song.
The happenstance of my birthday has really influenced my work in some basic ways.
My name is Christopher Ashcraft. I was born on January 20th, 1985, the day Ronald Reagan was inaugurated for his second term.
My Pulitzer Prize book, called A Good Son from a Strange Mountain, I went to Vietnam as a member of the U.S. Army. And ultimately, my book is really about all the Vietnamese who came to the United States. And that reassessment of self to become somebody that you were not before in a new land, it was a way for me to see who we are as Americans.
Yeah, it was definitely very exciting. First time being able to vote. I voted for Mitt Romney, and even though the person I chose didn't get in the office, it was still just a very memorable experience. Obviously, I didn't vote for Obama, but I wish him best of luck because he's still our president, and you know, I just hope that going forward he can help boost this country back up and hopefully provide opportunities for everyone.
I do travel for my job, and I mean, even outside of work, I always try to travel. And my dad, he asked me why I would want to leave the United States where I have everything I could ever want.
It is of concern to me that Ronan, how is he going to be able to attend a university and make it affordable? It's getting so much more expensive.
You know, I can't say I'm optimistic at this point. The economic collapse really affected me. I've moved back in with my parents twice. I know a lot of my friends have too. After degrees, they've taken unpaid internships for months and months, just kind of struggling to get by.
My feeling is that we have lost track of what democracy is all about. And certainly this has its effect on the economy as well. I mean, if there's anything that the Constitutional Fathers understood is everyone gives something in order to live with those who have a different opinion.
People are kind of saying like, oh my gosh, America is going down the drain, but we've gone through a lot worse than this.
John Haas produced that piece for us. All of our inauguration coverage is online. Profiles of people born on inauguration days, a timeline of notable firsts in inauguration history, and a series of essays about a subject near and dear to the Obama's heart, hope, from authors like Jeffrey Eugenides. It's at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, not at all inauguration related, but it is perhaps the perfect punctuation mark to the Oprah Winfrey Lance Armstrong interview of last week. Comes to us courtesy of the Manly Library. That's one of the local libraries down near Sydney, Australia. There was a sign posted in the library this past weekend. All nonfiction Lance Armstrong books, it said, will soon be moved to the fiction section. Alas, it was just a prank, a sign posted by a part-time weekend staffer, but still, pretty good one though, right? Wish I'd thought of it. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the markets were off for Martin Luther King Day. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Jolie Podokas, Mary Dew, and Chow Tew. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.